And now we will be moving into the first formal session of the conference. And the theme is on mindfulness. So vitamin M has taken on a new meaning. It's now vitamin mindfulness. So there's been a lot of discussion about how mindfulness has been taken out of Buddhism and introduced into various settings, including healthcare. Some of us who have been involved in the movement of mindfulness, Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn is one person who has contributed significantly in bringing mindfulness into the healthcare setting. He founded Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program in the University of Massachusetts Hospital. And since then, it has been spread to over 400 hospitals around the world and adopted by various people in managing pain, chronic stress. And University, Oxford University in England has also adapted MBSR into MBCT, which is Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy by Professor Mark Williams. And it has also been introduced to help people overcome depression and the relapse of depression. So mindfulness is certainly a topic that is now heavily discussed, and to some Buddhist purists would say that this has been adulteration of mindfulness. So we are here to discuss this topic today, and we are going to start with none other than Ajahn Brahm, who will be opening the session on this topic, on what is right mindfulness according to Buddhist theory and practice. Ajahn Brahm, please.
Thank you. So I'm just too lazy to go to the lectern, so I'm going to just sit here. But a couple of stories so that you know what's right mindfulness and what is wrong mindfulness. First of all, that mindfulness has to be kept in the context. I mentioned last night that mindfulness would always be put together with wisdom. And wisdom is, includes kindness, compassion. It's why you're being mindful. And a good example of that is that at a conference which I was attending in Vietnam a few years ago, like many conferences, we had breakout sessions where we had one particular topic, a leader of the discussion, to talk about it and bring it back to the plenary session where everybody attended and to give a report. And I recall with a mixture of incredulity and also laughter when there was one person who was very, very strong in a mindful-based tradition who was asked to give her report on the session which she led. And when she got up from the sofa and walked to the lectern, she did mindful walking. When she got up, she was mindful of every part of her body as it lifted up from the sofa. As she stood on the solid ground, she was very aware of her feet, and she lifted the foot very slowly and put it forward. By the time she got to the lectern, the 10 minutes for her presentation had run out, and the MC told her to come back and sit down. That actually happened. There is a time to walk fast, a time to walk slowly. If you are doing mindfulness, as you sometimes see people crossing a busy road, the red or the green man or woman sometimes these days you see flashing, you've only got a few seconds to get across that busy intersection. So just trying to be mindful without being wise gets you into very silly situations. So the mindfulness must also be with wisdom. Otherwise, it is very much wrong mindfulness. There's a time to be aware of your breathing. But please, Indy and Pia, when you are driving me back after this conference, please do not be mindful of your breath. Please be mindful of the traffic. Otherwise, I'm in big trouble. And also, still recall the time when a young man, maybe 11 or 12, came into my monastery in Serpentine in Western Australia, highly agitated. And I said, what's wrong with you? And he said, Ajahn Brahm, you've got to go over to your retreat center to check it out. I said, why? And he said, there's zombies in your retreat center. What do you mean zombies? He said, I saw all these people walking really slowly because that's what zombies do. So from this day on, sometimes we call slow walking meditation zombie meditation. So there is time and place. Mindful of what is really important to be mindful of. That is one of the first things which separates right mindfulness from wrong mindfulness, with wisdom as well. And also, never think that mindfulness is always the same. Everyone is mindful. Even a drunk person can find their way home. They have a very little degree of mindfulness, but not much. Just like right now, because of the lights in my face, I can hardly see you out there. But if the lights were put on you rather than me, I could be very aware of who's sitting here. So mindfulness is different degrees of mindfulness. Like weak mindfulness, powerful mindfulness, super powerful mindfulness. And depends on really what your task is. Just wrong mindfulness can be just not enough mindfulness to really see what is going on. And that is something which is important in all parts of science. Having been a theoretical physicist before, you know the power of observation can sometimes not be strong enough to see what's really going on. Literally, you cannot penetrate into the matter fully enough. And I did mention that in my talk last night about the phenomena which many people experience, that when you do create a strong mind and strong mindfulness, that it does penetrate and see things which you never really thought you could see before. The simile I'm going to give today is a simile of walking up the hillside in the monastery where I live. It's a great simile on the different levels of mindfulness and their importance. For 7 years, I have been living in this monastery on top of a hill just south of Perth. We decided to build a monastery on top of a hill because of tradition. Because all holy men and women should live on top of a hill. That's where holy men live. It's tradition. You never see a holy man living in a swamp, with the exception of Yoda. But that's Hollywood, that's not real life. You're supposed to live on top of a mountain. So we bought a mountain, or a hill, it's the best we could do. It's really hopeless in Chicago, I think Toronto's pretty flat as well, isn't it? So you don't find many holy men in Toronto, there's not enough hills. With the exception of Venerable Savanapala. the other monks in this place. But, like many people, up and down that hill in a car, and one day decided to walk. And as I walked, strange experience, I could not recognize my surroundings. It looked totally different than I'd remembered. And that was strange. I saw things I'd never seen before. And the colors were deeper. When I stood still and just stared, I saw things I never imagined would be there in that hillside. That's why I looked totally different. Little rocks, moss on the rocks. Little plants poking their little heads out from the grass could see the stream in the bottom of the valley and little rocks and little waterfalls and how beautiful it all looked. Even the green of the grass, its depth was richer than I could ever imagine seeing before. And it was such a weird experience that afterwards I contemplated it. What is going on? Why 7 years of passing a hillside which I thought I knew so well, I could see it in a different way. And soon I just used basic science, just a little bit of basic neuroscience, that the process of sight light reaches the back of your eye, the retina, it's a chemical reaction, happens, and I remember the times when you used to play around developing your own photographs at school in the days before digital cameras. You put the photographic paper in the chemical solution and slowly an image would emerge on that paper. If you took that paper out too soon, the image wasn't fully formed. The colors were pastel, washed out, and the detail was absent. You leave it in there long enough to develop and you have the full picture with the deep colors. That's what happens on the back of your eye. And if you could understand, looking through the window of a speeding car, something hits the back of your eye, an image forms. Before it fully forms, you have to attend to another image. The next image comes up, throws the last one out, and then another image, and another image. None of those images is fully complete, and the colors are not full. But when you slow down and walk, you see much more, and the colors are richer. But when you actually slow down and stop, that is the only time when the sense of sight can fully see what's out there. That is when the colors are deep and rich, and when all the detail reveals itself. One of the problems with us is we go too fast, and we think we're mindful, but without slowing down, without stillness, mindfulness is not strong enough to see what is truly going on. So that's one of the reasons why it's not just mindfulness, not just kindness, but the stillness is also important for developing mindfulness. Mindfulness is fantastic, but how is it nurtured, strengthened, so it becomes really penetrating? And that is where the importance of stillness, being so calm, so still, your mindfulness becomes so strong. And the beautiful byproduct of that is everything looks more beautiful. The sign of strong mindfulness is always joy, happiness, bubbliness. You've got energy. What you see is so beautiful, as I mentioned last night, with my unforgettable simile of the contents of the toilet bowl. So that's the next thing, that superpower mindfulness, which is very needed. Otherwise, you miss too much. As a scientist, made many friends, and 2 years ago when we had our conference over in Perth, there was one of my best friends, you know, who I grew up with in Cambridge, Professor Bernard Carr, a close associate of Stephen Hawking's. Stephen went to his marriage, to Bernard's marriage to Murray, and Bernard was also into the same things as I was into. He was the first Buddhist I ever met, but that's another story. And he was also into psychic research, a part of science which goes on places where most scientists would not dare to go, thinking they may lose their reputations. But because of that, he told me this wonderful story about some of the weaknesses in mindfulness, wrong mindfulness when it's not based on a correct view. There was the experiment of the levitating flower pot. You can read about this in the Journal of Psychic Research, where it was published nowhere else, and you can obviously understand the reason why, because it was embarrassing for many top-notch scientists. This was an experiment performed in Imperial College in London, when a friend of Bernard's, also a very, very highly regarded physicist, invited many of his friends, professors, very top researchers, people who were supposed to be trained in observation. And he claimed he was going to levitate a flower pot in laboratory conditions under video cameras so it could be confirmed. And he managed to get many of his very highly regarded scientists to come into this demonstration. And he brought the flower pot in, carried it in, no wires, no funny business, put it on the table, the bench, which you may remember seeing in a university science lecture halls. Put it on the bench, and claimed he was now going to levitate this flower pot, but he needed the help of all the people in the audience. He asked them all to chant the great spiritual sound of Om. So all these crusty old professors were chanting Om, Om, Om. And as they were chanting, the flower pot rose into the air. It levitated. And they got proof of that. The cameras were there. And afterwards, they asked the physicists, scientists, what they thought of the levitating flower pot. And several of them said, "What are you talking about? It did not levitate. It was on the table all the time." That was the point of the experiment. In mindfulness and perception of something you think can never happen. The point was, underneath that bench was a huge electromagnet. And they had to chant Om, because whenever you turn on a very powerful current, it hums, and that would give the game away. So the Om was there just to mask what was really going on. But that wasn't the point. The point was, it actually rose. But because many people were of the view, it cannot happen, therefore it never even registered on their awareness. Mindfulness was not a true reflection of reality when it is bent by your views, what you think is true, and what you think cannot happen. That is why wrong mindfulness will happen very often when it's something we think cannot happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Yes, I think it might be better to take a seat there so it's easier for you to view the next speaker. And our next speaker is Venerable Dhammajiva, and he's going to be addressing the question on teaching mindfulness to police officers in Toronto. Is it a simple meditation class? And did it take it by storm? So this is obviously a very interesting topic. And Venerable Dhammajiva is a highly respected meditation master with over 35 years of experience. Wrong topic. It's okay. It's a Buddhist conference. We can always change things on the fly as a show of impermanence in action. Oh, okay. Thank you. I probably got it wrong. Okay. And the topic. So let me just finish the introduction of Venerable Dhammajiva. He has over 35 years of experience in training and teaching Buddhist meditation techniques and is formerly the abbot of and chief preceptor at the Mitri Rigala Nisaravanaya, a renowned Sri Lankan Buddhist forest monastery. And his correct topic is mindfulness methods used in Buddhist meditation. May I now welcome Venerable Dhammajiva, and please join me in welcoming him. Thank you.
Dear Venerable sisters and brothers, Dhamma friends, as you know, I'm going to take about 15 minutes about these mindfulness methods used in Buddhist meditation. Dear Venerable sisters and brothers, Dhamma friends, it is fitting to begin my presentation by reminding ourselves that no other discourse of the Buddha, not even the inaugural famous Sermon of the Benares, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, enjoyed the fame and the reverence, and thus the discourse which described the heart of Buddhist meditation. That is Satipatthana Sutta. Conveniently translated as the Satipatthana is as the way of mindfulness. But a deep understanding of this cardinal teaching of the Buddha make us through the in-depth significance of the practical application of mindfulness meditation, right to the full liberation of Nibbana. The ancient practice of mindfulness, this Buddhist meditation, as is practiced today, as it was 25 centuries ago. It is applicable in every part of the world, irrespective of the whether we are followers of the Buddha teachings or not. Indeed, mindfulness methods are almost ubiquitous in their value, in its value. They offer an indispensable prescription for the overcoming sorrow and lamentation, for destruction of pain and grief. Famous in its application, Ekayano Ayam Bhikkhave Maggo Sattanam Visuddhiya. The Buddha solemnly and emphatically makes an equivocal guarantee that the consistent practitioner of the mindfulness will be treading the path that ensures the stage-by-stage purification of the mind, leading to the final liberation. Sati, that's the Pali term for the mindfulness, is mental state that enables the bare attention, the ability to be in the present moment. Habitually, we are either ruminating about the past or dreaming in the fantasizing about the future. It is very rare that we are here and now, in the present moment. With training, the mind will be able to apply this bare attention, in Pali we can say sati matraya, to every present arising moment, without judgment. This is stream of mindfulness we can develop with practice. And this is possibility for every human being, irrespective of whether he is a follower of the Buddha's teaching or not. Sati, or this bare attention, is the precursor for the application of mindfulness as prescribed in the Satipatthana Sutta. It's a mastery initially necessary to make us through the meditation of mindfulness on the four objects: mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the feelings, mindfulness of the mind and the mental phenomena, mindfulness of the object of mindfulness of the phenomena. These four objects of mindfulness comprise the entire human beings and his field of experience. The Satipatthana method is based on the fundamentals of the thoroughness, or we can say diligence or vigilance, where practice of mindfulness range from neutrally simple, not threatening objects such as breath, or the four cardinal postures or traditional postures of human beings, in sitting, in standing, in walking and lying down. To spiritually lofty observance of phenomena that impinge on the mind. The specific individuals with certain personality traits, the Buddha had included seemingly grotesque practice such as symmetry contemplation and the reflection of the impurities of the body, contemplation of the elemental nature of the body, that is Dhatu Manasikara in Pali, would also seem a curious object to meditate upon. However, deep study of the Pali Canon enables discovery on why these practices are important and how they are applicable as per each meditator's propensities or underlying tendencies to be practiced under the guidance of a teacher. Sati not only forms the basis for the Satipatthana practice, but it also occupies a certain position among the five faculties, that five indriyas, the five powers, or panchabala, and it constitutes the first member of the seven awakening factors, that is Sattabodhyanga, finally, it forms a basis for the Sammasati, right mindfulness, the seventh factor among the Noble Eightfold Path, the fourth Noble Truth, the essence of the Buddha's teaching. For all these critical components that comprise the 37 aids to enlightenment, we call 37 factors of enlightenment, Satta, Sattis Bodhipakshiya Dhamma. Bear attention or sati stands out as the pivotal prerequisite. There's a book in your brochure called Power of Mindfulness. Please go through it. And in that book, Venerable Jnanaponika is presenting how to recognize this bear attention, how it forms first into sati and develop stage by stage. Sati itself is evolving 8 times when you go up to the final liberation. So don't try to give a fixed definition for the sati. Let it evolve. The path and the steps prescribed in Sarojavatana are gradual and sequential. It is precise roadmap that follow master of the four foundation of mindfulness by novice meditators as well as by experienced trainees or seka. With such mastery, both categories of person will be able to experience the first hand with almost microscopic precision what the Buddha referred to as mind transformation that is unparalleled and unique. What is to be mastered and transcended has first to be known and understood. And to that end, the four objects of mindfulness, for example, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the feeling, mindfulness of the mind, and the mindfulness of the phenomena, need to be practiced repeatedly. With sense of dispassion and thorough, and through they belongs to another. Many things are better understood when observed in others rather than in oneself. Therefore, a close and impartial scrutiny of oneself is possible when mindfulness is consistently applied with least keeping oneself aloof and distance. Dear respected sisters and brothers, the heart of Buddhist meditation is indeed the heart of the Buddha's doctrine. Training in mindfulness as a Satipatthana practice is also a training in the mind charter and developing wholesome traits of the mind. Lest it may be interpreted that the Buddhist mindfulness meditation practice are intellectually lofty, but are cold and dry and indifferent to ethics. I need to add a few words of the elaboration. The master himself on many occasions, as specified in the Pali Canon, has emphasized with great clarity that an indispensable basis for any higher mental development is morality and ethical conduct. And that morality, safest roots, lie in the character and the nature of the mind. The Buddha's teaching, the state of mind, enjoyed the significantly the prominent place amongst, as if giving credence to the claim that the Buddha Dhamma is in fact a mental training and mind development regiment, rather than a spiritual teaching and a religion. But true understanding of the doctrine directs us to the value of the Buddha's place on the mind's character. And this is ideally expressed in the divine abode of the mind over the Brahma Vihara meditation, the loving kindness, the compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. The Satipatthana methods provide the instrument of the mindfulness that will enable keeping a close watch to that no deed, no word or thought offended, offends the spirit of metta or loving kindness. The famous Karnimitta Sutta says, with the, he stands, walks, sits or lie down, as long as he is awake, he should develop mindfulness. This, they say, is the highest conduct. Dear respected sisters and brothers, today we live in the unhappy and dangerous world. Escalating conflicts and terror, prejudices and acrimony among the different groups of human beings who differ either due to religion or race or due to ideology, cast a gloomy shadow over the old nations, devastation of our lands and seas and the entire ecology system, manipulative and deceitful cyber crimes. All are terrifying to say the least. Hunger for power, more and more power. The thirst for acquiring assets and more assets. The investment in and the production of weapons and equipments that can destroy entire nation. Go on escalating ceaselessly. Quoting Venerable Jnanaponika, the very book that you are holding now, to this sick and truly demented world of ours, there comes an ancient teaching of the eternal wisdom and unfolding guidance of the Buddha Dhamma with its message of and power of healing. The ancient teaching of the mindfulness meditation sits at the heart of the Buddha's teaching, the Dhamma. Mindfulness, penetrative ability and sharp focus shines powerful torch on the human mind. Mindfulness has unparalleled ability to examine the inner working of the mind. The exposed greed, hatred and delusion that forms the basis for our destructive, distasteful actions. Our hateful speech, our unpleasant thoughts. The uniqueness of mindfulness is that it can show us our deadliest tendencies as well as our most beautiful mind states. Whenever they arise, mindfulness allows us to peep into the deep, dark crevices of the mind where roots of the evil lie hidden, waiting to surface. What better instrument than the mindfulness to accost our darkest elements, enemies, the defilement that fetter us to this journey of samsara. This is the teaching of the Buddha, share with us. He showed us we do have a way, a simple but powerful way, to know our mind and purify it through the systematic satipatthana meditation. Today's turbulent world, we are also seeing the strong and vibrant breath of fresh air that's sweeping across from the west to the east, becoming popular day by day. The practice of bare attention of mindfulness has begun to resonate inside classrooms, within university campuses, hospitals and central legislative bodies like the parliament in the Great Britain. So, understanding this, we have to teach our children, future generation, for that only we have this kind of conferences, developing our confidence and present it to the next generation. That's all what I have to share with you. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thank you very much, Venerable Dhammajiva. And now we will have the third speaker for this session, and he is a bhikkhu in the Theravadan Buddhist tradition, and he's been practicing intensive and daily meditation following the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition over the last 17 years. He has been teaching intensive meditation in Thailand, Sri Lanka, the U.S., and Canada. The topic would be Wrong Mindfulness and Its Consequences According to the Buddha. Please join me to welcome Yutadhammo Bhikkhu.
Venerable members of the Mahasangha, good morning, everyone. So today I was asked to talk about wrong mindfulness, which is interesting because the Buddha was quite clear that mindfulness is always good. In the Abhidhamma, it's called a sobhana jetasika, so it's a beautiful mind state. And so what I'd like to do is explore some of the ways that mindfulness can go wrong. The Buddha himself did use the term wrong mindfulness. It's not something that we came up with. But mindfulness itself is a positive state. So I'd like to first look at, I know the other two speakers have talked a little bit about it already, but about mindfulness. So I'm just going to give a technical description if I can figure out how this thing works. So with any Dhamma in the traditional Theravada texts, we have four qualities or four aspects that we use to define it. The characteristic, the function, the manifestation, and the proximate cause. This is with all Dhammas. Does this thing work? I got the wrong one. My other talk is on technology, so I have something to say about that tomorrow. No, it works for you. Technology isn't. I did. Repeatedly. Okay, oh, there we go. Okay. So the characteristic. The characteristic of mindfulness is not wobbling. The ordinary mind wobbles. It wavers, it isn't stable, it isn't fixed on an object. Mindfulness is able to grasp the object. Its function is to not forget. So ordinary mindfulness can actually refer to remembering things that happened a long time ago in the past, the ability to recollect something. But in Satipatthana, in mindfulness meditation practice, it means to not forget the object in the present moment. So ordinarily we experience something and then right away, we're often the mind judging it, reacting to it, and we forget about the object. You see something, but you're not interested in the seeing, you're interested in what it means. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it me? Is it mine? And so on. Mindfulness doesn't do that. Mindfulness sticks with the actual object. It is manifested as guarding. So mindfulness guards the mind. It guards the mind from defilements, specifically. An ordinary mind is unguarded, and so lots of defilements are able to enter. Or it is manifested simply as confronting the objective field. And so what this means is an ordinary mind is unable to confront. It's like when an experience comes, and if it's an unpleasant experience, the mind shies away from it. If it's a pleasant experience, the mind immediately chases after it. But to just sit and confront the object, this is mindfulness. To be able to be with a positive or a negative experience without reacting. Okay, this is fun. Its proximate cause is strong perception. So the proximate cause means what gives rise to mindfulness, tira sanya. So this is the Pali. Sanya is a perception of something. When you perceive that you're seeing, the perception of seeing, well, that's sanya. When you perceive that you're hearing a cat meowing, the perception of the cat, that's sanya. But tira sanya is when you reaffirm it. It becomes strengthened. So this is what meditation does. When you practice meditation, for example, the texts give the object of a disk of earth. If you're looking at earth, then you just repeat to yourself, earth, 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 or batui, batui. And by doing that, your mind stays focused on the object. You strengthen the perception. This is going to take longer than 15 minutes if I can't get through this. Okay. Or, simply put, the proximate cause is the practice of the four foundations of mindfulness, which the other monks have gone through. It should be okay, and then we got a couple of similes. So it should be regarded as a pillar. Like I said, the function or the characteristic is to not wobble. So the texts talk about this idea of a gourd floating on the top of the water. It flits about here and there, as compared to a pillar sunk in the bottom of the lake. No matter how the waves or the wind buffet it, it doesn't shake. Mindfulness is like the pillar. Or it is like a doorkeeper because it guards the eye and the ear and so on. So the sense doors. The sense doors are where all of our experience comes and therefore where all of the problems come. And if the mindfulness is there, it lets the experience in without letting in the defilements. So that's mindfulness. When we talk about wrong mindfulness, then the question is, well, what then does that mean? And I've come up with four categories that I think, according to the Buddha's teaching, relate to this idea of wrong mindfulness. I'll just go through them. The first is unmindfulness. So unmindfulness is just the opposite of mindfulness. If you never go to a meditation center or never take up the practice of meditation, you're generally unmindful. So your mind wobbles. This is the opposite, right? Your mind is forgetful, so you can't remember things that happened yesterday, and you can never remember the present moment. You experience something and immediately you react. You don't confront the object, and it's caused by weak perception. You perceive something, but your mind is not trained, right? Your mind is not well developed in order to stick with the perception, so you get lost in your reactions. The second is something called misdirected mindfulness. So this type of mindfulness is not actually wrong in a general sense. Just like if you want to go to Niagara Falls, you've got to get on the QEW. If you get on the 400, you're on your way to Sudbury. There's nothing wrong with the 400. It's just it doesn't lead to Niagara Falls. By the same token, if you practice mindfulness of the past, remembering even your past lives, for example, it's never going to allow you to attain enlightenment because it's focused on the wrong object. Nothing wrong with it. It's just a mundane object, or it's a conceptual object. Mindfulness of the future is the same. If you're able to plan ahead, or if you're even able to have an experience of precognition where you see something before it happens, could be considered a form of mindfulness, but doesn't help you because it's not focused on actual reality as you experience it. And of course, mindfulness of concepts. Now, mindfulness of concepts is a valid meditation technique. So if you focus on a candle flame, for example, or as I said, the disk of earth, eventually you're able to see this object in your mind conceptually. Now that object is stable, it's satisfying, and it's even controllable. You can expand it, you can contract it, you can enter into very high states of calm with it. But it's not going to lead you to enlightenment because it's a concept. It's not impermanent, it's not anicca, dukkha, anatta. You're not going to see the three characteristics. The third is something I'd call lapsed mindfulness. And so this is like unmindfulness, except the key here is that this arises in someone who is practicing correctly. Because for every meditator, we're not robots, we're not machines, this isn't an assembly line where we pass people through and they all come out enlightened. Everyone has conditions that they come to the meditation with, and so everyone has a different experience. Often this shows itself as positive states. It can also show itself as negative states, deep states that we keep hidden inside. So the texts deal with some of the good ones. These are positive states that arise because you're practicing correctly. But they themselves are not the path. They themselves will not lead you to enlightenment. And unfortunately, sometimes meditators start to think that they will. For example, you see bright lights or colors or pictures and you say, oh, that must be the path to enlightenment. Or knowledge that you gain about your problems or knowledge about past lives or being able to read people's minds, many different kinds of knowledge that you get caught up in. Rapture, you can feel energy or lightness or goosebumps. All of these things can distract you from being mindful. Tranquility, sometimes you feel very calm and then you don't know what to do because there's nothing to be mindful of, except you can be mindful of the calm, and we forget this. Happiness, meditators often feel great happiness. And again, all of these are good things. Problem is when you get attached to it and stop being mindful of it. Confidence, of course, being mindful suddenly focuses your mind and makes you very confident. Suddenly you're very sure of yourself, sure of your teacher, sure of your practice, sure of the Buddha. And you get caught up in that and think, wow, this is great, this is the best, and you're no longer mindful. Exertion, you gain a great amount of energy from the practice, and this can distract you. Sometimes you have to get up and run around because you have so much energy. mindfulness, even mindfulness. Because you gain such clear mindfulness, you start to become complacent and you think, boy, am I mindful. It happens. It happens more often than one might think. It's kind of funny that mindfulness can be a distraction. Equanimity, you become very calm and you think, wow, I'm enlightened. This is great. Equanimity comes and goes. And if it still goes, well, it's not enlightenment. And finally, attachment. Attachment is really the problem if you're attached to any of these. Okay. Or if you're attached to anything, really, attached to sights or sounds or anything, this will lead you to get distracted. So your mindfulness will lapse. The final thing that I would call wrong mindfulness is, I think, what Brahmavamsa was talking about. And I think this is probably what the Buddha really meant by wrong mindfulness when he talked about the Eightfold Noble Path, right? And these are the other seven factors. So we have wrong view and so on and so on. And the point is that mindfulness is impotent if it's not associated with the other seven path factors. So if you have wrong view, as the Venerable said, it's going to, no matter how mindful you are, if you still believe in things like the soul or the self, or if you don't believe in karma, if you have, you know, think that God created us and so on, all of this is going to prevent you from seeing clearly the ordinary experience. Wrong thought, wrong speech. If you have bad intentions or ambitions, cruelty in the mind and that kind of thing. If you're a liar, if you're a gossip, if you just talk a lot, it's going to get in the way of mindfulness. If you're a murderer, if you're a thief, if you take drugs or alcohol, all of these, of course, are going to get in the way. You can try your best at being mindful. But if you aren't keeping, for example, keeping the five precepts, I would never teach someone a meditation course if they weren't able to keep at least the five precepts. It's just futile. Wrong livelihood, so if you make a living out of those bad things. Wrong effort, if you're lazy, or if your effort is directed towards the cultivation of unwholesomeness. All of that will prevent mindfulness from being effective. And if wrong concentration, if you're unfocused, or if you're focused on the wrong things. So, idea being, the Eightfold Noble Path has to work together. Mindfulness is not enough. Mindfulness is like the key that starts the engine, gets everything going. But if your engine's broken, key doesn't do much. So we have some consequences. This is the last thing I'll talk about. I've got a few minutes left. The first consequence of wrong mindfulness potentially is regression. And so this isn't that, it's unfortunate, but it isn't that dangerous. Regression just means you get discouraged. You, instead of gaining wholesome states, you regress. You become unmindful and you get afraid of the practice or upset with the practice. You think the practice is useless because, well, you're not doing it properly. And so one leaves the practice, even leaves Buddhism, even begins to disparage Buddhism as useless and so on, which is unfortunate. Stagnation is also common. It's common for meditators to practice for years without becoming enlightened. They practice and they're very calm and peaceful, but they never gain insight because they never actually look at the four satipatthana. Instead, they're focused, say, on concepts. If someone practices loving kindness, it's a great thing. If one practices focusing on a candle flame, eventually, apparently, you can learn to shoot fireballs out of your hands. It's great fun, but not going to lead you to enlightenment. This isn't me. The ancient texts are full of these things. This apparently is a thing. Complication, the third consequence, is of course the most dangerous. Mindfulness is of course designed to simplify things. As the Buddha said, when you see, let it just be seeing. This is how you should train yourself. When you hear, let it just be hearing. When you experience something, let it just be the experience. When you're unmindful, or if you have a sort of a, technically speaking, perverted state of mindfulness in the sense of having one of the other path factors missing, it complicates things. It can actually create mind states that are more tense, more stressed, more poisonous. And through repeated and intensive practice, it's actually possible to wind yourself up so that you lose your mindfulness entirely and go what we might call temporarily insane. You're unable to control yourself. I've seen this happen. Never happened with any of my meditators, but I've seen it where a meditator will lose their mindfulness. And that's, of course, the most dangerous. So I don't have a lot of time. I'm out of time, actually, but I hope we can talk about this a little more. I'm really interested to. I have much more to say on this topic. But of course, wrong mindfulness is a thing, and it's something we'll have to be concerned with. So thank you very much. I appreciate all of your attention.
Thank you very much, Bhikkhu. And now we will be having a Q&A session, which I would like to invite all of you to participate. And there will be microphones placed at the bottom of the stairs. So please walk mindfully down to the microphone. And I'd like to invite all the three speakers to come out on stage to be present for this Q&A session. So we have definitely heard a lot about the different definitions of mindfulness and the application of right mindfulness and the consequences of using the term mindfulness in the wrong way and also in applying mindfulness in the wrong way. So hopefully that has provoked some of your thoughts and to, in fact, come up to question and even challenge. And I hope even the speakers on stage will not always agree, because after all, challenging each other and questioning is very much part of the Buddhist teachings, that we're not to accept just anything we hear as truth. After all, that is one of the Buddha's main teachings of Kalama Sutta. So anyone would like to get the ball rolling? Yes, we have a first question here by this gentleman.
Hello. There we go. Thanks. Venerable Yutadhamma,
big question. Could you just kindly state your name and
My name is Tristan Muhammad. I just have a question for you and also for Ajahn Brahm, I guess, can speak on this too. I know you talk about lapsed mindfulness and things like equanimity and lights being part of that group as like, I guess, a distraction from the path. So how does that reconcile with many of the suttas where the Buddha does talk about the four jhanas and the nimittas and leading to that path of enlightenment?
Thank you.
Yeah, to be clear, these are all positive states. There's nothing wrong with them. The problem is when they lead you to be unmindful, when instead you start with lights, for example. I mean, it's very common for a meditator to see images and they'll get distracted by them and start to say, oh, I wonder where that leads. And the thing about images, they're conceptual. They can become whatever you want. And suddenly you're seeing dragons, and then you're suddenly seeing demons, and then suddenly you're caught up in a hell state. You don't know where you are. I mean, it is possible to get distracted. I mean, this isn't something I came up with. This is in the ancient text. So certainly it has no reflection on the idea that the jhanas are important. But the thing about the jhanas is they're very specific and focused states. They're with the guidance of a teacher to keep you on track. With all these states, they're certainly considered to be a part of the practice, which is why it's different from unmindfulness. The point is, these things can distract a person and cause them to be unmindful.
Thank you,
that helps.
And I think you asked Ajahn Brahm as well to clarify this question. So.
I always like to focus that one of the prerequisites, the foundations of every of the four Satipatthanas, the Viriccha Vakkhamehi, Viriccha Akusalehi Dhammehi, which is described in the commentaries of both the Mahasatipatthana and the Satipatthana in the Majjhima Nikaya as overcoming the five hindrances. In other words, when you have the five hindrances which stop you being peaceful and also just pervert perception, block your wisdom, so there it is said freely that they're only overcome, you know, through the jhanas. And so it's the jhanas' job of actually clearing the mind of, you know, what causes some of the wrong views, which keeps the old views really strong and going, which is you see what you want to see and you can't see what challenges you. Those are basically the first two of the five hindrances. And so when you read the Satipatthana very closely, Viriccha Kammehi, Viriccha Akusalehi Dhammehi, the prerequisite, you know, is to weaken those five hindrances. And that is part of the job of the jhanas. And it's, you know, said very clearly every time that from samadhi, samadhi pachaya yata bhuti yana dasana. I'm only saying the Pali just to give myself some cred. I don't just tell jokes. And what that really means, you know, is from, and I never called it concentration. I think that is a wrong perception. It is called stillness. Because stillness actually informs a different path of deep meditation. Concentration is through force. Stillness is from letting go, from kindness. And from the stillness, you know, we do see things as they truly are. Samadhi, tathya, yata buddhi yana dasana. From the stillness, we see things as they truly are. Not from sati. And I always like to quote also the Manibhadaraka Samyutta, where there was a yaka asked the Buddha, said, being mindful, you can live happily every day. And the Buddha said, no. Because when you're angry, mindfulness is not strong enough. You need metta. And that was a very, very clear thing which was pointed out to me. Sati, mindfulness, is not enough in and of itself. Manibhada, Raka, Samyutta. So, the path to the ending of all things, Satipatthana is great, it's important. But actually I think it's, you know, just too much. Too much focus on that one factor of the path and forgetting the other seven factors of the path. I think that's also really important as well. As it says in verse, I think, was it 372? Dhammapada, Ezawa Mago, and I think I've got that number wrong. Ezawa Mago, Nati Anyo Dasanasa Visuddhiya. This is the only path, there is no other, for the purity of insight. And that's my translation of dasana, referring unequivocally to the Eightfold Path. So sati is great, but we also need the other seven factors as well.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for displaying your Cambridge mind.
Okay.
So I'd like to invite the next speaker. Thank you. Oh, sorry, so for that side, I thought there were two other people here.
My name is Julie Yu. I'm from, this microphone's too low.
Oh, yeah, you can remove it. Thank you.
Okay. I'm a physician from upstate New York. I took refuge a couple of years ago, meditation probably only 1 or 2 days. The questions are for all of you. You have experience of teaching meditation, mindfulness meditation. The reason I come here is because actually some of my patients are asking whether there's a program, mindful stress reduction program in upstate. I said no. So I think maybe this weekend I'm not on call. Maybe I'll come here, can find an answer. So for first part, I heard it's complication and the wrong mindfulness. So I was wondering, is that practice with that teacher could be dangerous?
Would you like to direct it to one of the speakers?
Sorry, besides Ajahn Brahm, I am so bad.
You can just say on the right, left,
on the
middle.
Right.
On the right, okay.
Well, I'm sure you probably want to hear from the more senior monks as well, but so complication, I think, is much more likely without a teacher. I mean, I've seen happen is in meditation centers. Also, sometimes too much teaching from people who aren't trained and aren't qualified to do it. So if you, because we're dealing with the mind, this is the most powerful tool in the universe, right? I mean, this is what's created all of this. It's what creates technology. The mind is more powerful than anything else, and you know, powerful means dangerous. If you don't know what you're doing, if you're just wandering through the forest blind, it happens. I've seen it happen. People go crazy, especially because, as I said, we're all different. For some people, there's a lot going on in the mind. So if your question is specifically practicing without a teacher, I would say, yes, that's a potential way that all three of those wrong mindfulnesses can easily arise. Regression, you know, giving it up, getting discouraged. Stagnation, where you just practice for years without getting anything, and complication, where you actually hurt yourself through the practice. Thank you.
That is a common question. We also should mention it is very dangerous not to meditate at all. So to compare it, meditation without a teacher, not meditating at all, I would actually focus, it's dangerous not the teacher, but the teaching. To actually to meditate with a good teaching, you don't find many of the problems, or any of them. And one of the things which I often sort of feel is the biggest danger is, again, just focus on one part and not the other parts of the Buddha's teachings, and especially things like kindness. And I found that too many people push in their meditation, and they forget this is basic kindness. If anybody wants to find out, which I sometimes, when I became a young Buddhist and started looking at the suttas, where is kindness in the Eightfold Path? And you'll find it in not right thought, samasankappa, no, thinking, I never feel is all that right, just gives you headaches. So that samasankappa, I've usually rendered it now as right motivation, where you're coming from when you're meditating. And there's three right motivations in the Pali, and that's the nekama, which means renouncing, letting go, not trying to attain something or get something. That's what my teacher kept on telling me again and again. We meditate to let go, not to get somewhere. So nekama. And the next one was avayapada. No ill will. Avayapada is a synonym. Same meaning as metta, compassion. It's right there in the middle of the second factor of the Eightfold Path. And the third one was ahimsaka, not doing any damage. Gentleness. So if you can focus just on that part of the Eightfold Path as well, which is important. If we forget that, or if we don't include that into our mindfulness practice, of course that's going to cause a lot of danger. If you're meditating to try and get somewhere, you'll just, it's more different type of greed. What the Vajrayana monk Trungpa said is spiritual materialism. A beautiful word. I didn't agree with much of his livelihood, but that was a great insight, spiritual materialism. Be careful of that. And of course, the kindness. You don't go around hitting people on the back or forcing people to sit for hours and hours and hours with pain. That breaks some very fragile minds. And also being very gentle. That was something which you felt was important in Buddhism. We should apply to our meditation practice as well. And that gives a huge amount of safeguards. So I would say, yeah, there is some possibility of dangers without a teacher, but it's more important that we have a good teaching.
Thank you.
Thank you for the benefit.
Thank you very much. So according to the answers given, no meditation with the teacher, and the alternative for me was reading books and listening to others. So likewise, there's another alternative also that is also very famous present day. So when I was in Burma, that question came to Pandita Sadhu. He told not going anywhere is the no meditation. Going with the map is the going with the books. And going with the guided, living guide is the going with the teacher. So he says, go with the book is the most people are doing. But if you are in the wrong path, the map won't tell you you are on the wrong path. But if you are going with the guide, the guide will teach you, but guide is very expensive. So exactly the same, when I became, and I wanted to go there, another foreign monk only taught me, being I am a born Buddhist, just like Achandram, Venerable Dhammika Travasti. And when he was teaching, he never assumes the teacher's role. He gave me some books. And at that time, it is very little number of books in Sinhala also. But he was a good friend. It took 8 years for me to understand that's just the meaning of the mindfulness. So having a teacher is very expensive. And you have to be a good student. And that is the way it is happening. But anyway, for the last 30, 40 years, I find there are a lot of, not a lot, but fairly a number of good teachers are there. So, but have a trial and error. And you must have the method to verify whether it's a concept or reality. It is up to you, by your trial and error also you can do. So therefore, we have a good hope in time to come. If it is a teacher best, don't do away taking this as an excuse. There are some good talks. There are some good books. and you can do. And when and where possible, get a good chance, please present your experience to the teacher, and then teacher will help you to come into the correct path. So therefore, something is better than nothing.
Thank you, Venerable.
Thank you.
And I'd like to add that having been doing work in the mental health space, there are people who are suffering from mental illnesses, and then they go into the spiritual world, and in particular looking for meditation as an answer, and then blame it on, or someone ends up blaming on meditation rather than acknowledging that they already have a mental illness to start off with, whether it's schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, OCD, and many other forms of illnesses that affects the brain. So I'd like to, who has come first? You're okay? Right. Yes, please. Go ahead.
Yeah. I suppose that's me. my question is first of all, thank you so much to all the Venerables for coming this morning and delivering such inspiring words. But my question is more so directed towards Ajahn Brahm. In his latest response, he did mention that it was important to avoid spiritual materialism. And, materialism in general is something that is so characteristic of the Western world. And I wanted to have him just sort of elaborate on what he means by that and how, in fact, we can avoid, falling into that trap of something that is so ingrained in Western society.
Thank you.
It isn't true that many people, they hear about stages of enlightenment, paths and fruits, I want, I want, I want. And then you hear people saying, I'm more enlightened than you are. Unfortunately, you hear that. And for a bit of humor, I was told by a Sri Lankan gentleman in California, there was a group in Colombo who had this retreat, both of meditation and of study. And at the end of the retreat, maybe 4 or 5 weeks, they were giving out enlightenment certificates. And this is what happened. There was a really, really sweet, old, devout Sri Lankan auntie, from the upcountry, visiting her family in Colombo, and they said, what can we do to sort of give a nice gift to our auntie? And they heard about this retreat, said, we'll sponsor you to go. You've been such a pure hearted, such a giving person. You should do the other part of Buddhism as well, some meditation and some study. So she agreed. And at the end of the retreat, the organizers came up to her and said, Auntie, we're so pleased to tell you that we have decided that you have done really, really well, that you are now a stream winner, a soul one. And they gave her a certificate, which is an amazing, if it's a real soul one, first stage of enlightenment, that's incredible. And as soon as she was given the certificate, she got really upset and angry. So why are you angry at us, Auntie? This is a wonderful thing. You should be so joyful. You got the first stage of enlightenment. And she said, you don't remember me, do you? I was here 5 years ago and you gave me a non-returner certificate. You've demoted me. And that is an example of spiritual materialism. And it is very much a case of the sense of ego and self disappearing. Non-self, anatta. So who the heck can be a stream winner in enlightenment? You don't claim this as an attainment. You claim it as you're disappearing. And one of the monks, I don't know if you ever met Ananda Mangala. He was a very unconventional monk. He was around at the time with Venerable Narada, Piyadasi, and Sri Dhammananda. He was a very unconventional monk. And when he was asked if he's enlightened, he gave this brilliant answer. He said, well, I'm not fully enlightened, but I'm highly eliminated. So how can you have spiritual materialism when the goal is to be eliminated?
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. I hope the answer was satisfactory. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So I'd like to invite this lady here.
Thank you. I feel my heart beating.
Breathe.
I am. That's what I was doing, just trying to be within my body. Be aware of what was happening in my body. I'd like to direct this question first to Yuta Damo, the bhikkhu. Thank you for your talk. And what I'd like to know, if you can share this with me and the rest of us, is you mentioned that you have students and you teach them mindfulness and meditation. In your experience, is there a difference when you teach those who are very young, for example, in their late teens, early 20s, versus those that are older, perhaps over 50, over 60? I'd be very curious to know and interested to know what your experiences are with that. And also, if you have any tips or guidelines for teaching individuals in those age groups.
Which age groups particularly?
I would say in the early 20s, late teens, and in the over 60.
Again, I'd like to defer to the other two venerables as well, having much more experience. But just briefly, the Buddha was clear that, this is something I was going to talk about tomorrow as well, but the Buddha was quite clear that you shouldn't wait till you're very old to go forth, and there's a reason for that. There's a certain weakness to the body, but I think there's also a certain setness to your character. So any bad habits that you developed can be more pronounced and more difficult to overcome. On the other hand, of course, young people don't have this sort of sense of composure and some of life's experiences. Like you talk about a 15-year-old about old age, sickness and death, it's not going to have the same impact as it will on an older person. I think I'd like to sort of give a wishy-washy answer and say it really much depends on the individual. Yes, there's great differences, and age is a factor, but I don't know that it's going to make one better at practicing or worse. I think it's very much dependent, in my experience, on the individual. As far as tailoring it to the age groups, I don't really feel that. We deal, when you relate naturally to different age groups, of course you react differently. The Buddha, of course, interacted differently with all different types of people. But I think that comes naturally with just being mindful. And it's very, very much, dependent on the individual. Each person has their own. Because we've all been old, we've all been young, but we're all individual. What's the word? Snowflake.
Snowflake. Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Would the other two speakers like to add anything to that?
Regarding the introduction of mindfulness at the age base, in my experience, we have up to the last year. Giving mindfulness to the people coming often before over 60, or sometimes we get between 40 to 60 type, and very difficult to convince the value of mindfulness, even though they have frustration and mental diseases kind of thing. Later, I thought of giving it to a young children at the age of 10 up to 20, and that we taught only mindfulness, Bhante. We are not teaching kindness and kind of thing, but our action may be kindful. So next session, I will show you our results for the last 1 year. We have completely covered the Colombo district, the children from age 10 to 20. And we just give 5 minutes talk each day, just introducing mindfulness. As Venerable Yuttadhamma mentioned, they can't understand the therapeutic value of mindfulness, but they may understand the preventive type. So for that, the teacher, the parents, and the education department has to find the value and give the children. One of the fathers told me, when he's a very young child at about the eight, and doing some practice, one day he has asked, why don't you practice? He says, why should I practice? My mind is clear. And then he asked me, Bansi, now then what to do? Then I see that is the way it must be given, like a mindful game or mindful activity, not like a subject matter. So now we are collecting a bank of mindful activities, or mindful, we call mindful games. And associating Ajahn Brahm, I thought of introducing this kindful action or random action of kindness, that kind of thing, to how to make it welcoming to the children. So that is what my message to the parents, my message to the schools, how can we introduce mindfulness in the preventive way rather than the therapeutic. Of course, we have a lot of materials after the mental diseases and corruption and global warming, how mindfulness is working. But if you work it backward towards the preventive part, it is somewhat religious. It is somewhat philosophical. So elderly group, we are in such a critical age now. We know the value of mindfulness in the therapeutic part. We have to learn from the West and from Sri Lanka, and how to apply it to the preventive part. And I found it's very, very enlightening the way the children express themselves the meaning of mindfulness. How do they come to know? How do you put into practice? And therefore, it is an ongoing process. So I wish to invite Ajahn Brahm also in the next hour session to please come and share with us and give your wisdom how to make it more colorful by blending it with metta, or loving kindness and the compassion. So we are on the process.
Sorry, if I can just briefly, relating to very young, you didn't actually mention it, but jumping off of Damodji Mahamudra's comment or words, I've made cartoons for kids on how to be mindful. And really, just to emphasize that point, that it really, mindfulness is something that is fairly universal. And I showed these cartoons, one of my students showed them to her 3-year and 5-year-old daughters. And I did a Skype conference with them once, and the 3-year-old or the 5-year-old was teaching the 3-year-old how to be mindful. And they really, you know, how far they got on it, I don't know. But if with the right presentation, mindfulness is pretty incredible.
Thank you.
I'm really glad. Can I just make one more comment?
We have two more questions, one from online and one gentleman behind you. Okay. But I'd like to encourage anyone interested in mindfulness for children or young people is to check out Mindfulness in School Project. It's a very well-established and widely applied program in the UK, Mindfulness in School Projects. They teach Dot B and Pause B.
Thank you.
Especially tailored for children. Okay. So I need to pass the question to
thank
the...
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much.
Well, this is... my name is Eloy Pereira. I'm one of the volunteers and interested in Buddhism. And this question is a general question.
Okay, we're going to only be able to accommodate one answer from the audience. What? So if you could be a little bit precise.
Has it got to be on mindfulness?
Thank you.
Has it got to be on mindfulness?
Yes, please.
Yeah.
For this session. So
for this
if you could just keep
it
quick.
I understand. Because the question I have is something that Reverend Dhammajiva referred to in his speech.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah. Please make it quick.
Vante, you mentioned in your talk, you said that something that I really like very much about the divine state, and I have read about the Brahma Viharas, the divine abode, without any reference to a God or a creator or whatever it is. Could you expand it a little so that, because I feel this particular aspect is very important in giving the West a proper idea of what Buddhism is, what the development of human mind is.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
And could you just hold the answer there, and while we add on to the online question, because there's only one. By the way, there are 450 people, and this is a fully booked conference, plus there are almost 1,000 people online that's being streamed live, so of this conference. So if you could just share your question as well.
This question is from Chanel from the West Virginia University. She'd like to ask Yuta Damo to speak a bit more about complication that arises as consequence of wrong mindfulness, particularly as it might relate to meditators that also involve themselves in social justice work. She's interested in this as it relates to identity politics.
Okay, according to my time here, I've got 3 seconds. So I'm going to request for an extension of 2 minutes, and we're 1 minute each per speaker to give the answer, please. So concise and to the point.
Okay, well, I think social justice is very much concerned, in my mind, proper social justice is very much concerned with simplification. Complication, papancha, is when you create more suffering and more stress. So I think the real question is, and this is what I'm going to talk about tomorrow, so hopefully this answer will get some more attention then, is coordinating or harmonizing our outward expression in the world with our inner spirituality. So the question is your social justice creating complication, or is it helping the world to become more simple and more peaceful? I think that's about it.
Thank you.
Yes, that regarding the mindfulness related with the metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha, if you remember the way Achan expressed the way how to sit, whenever you sit comfortably, relaxed, and in the symmetric way, that's the way you become loving kindness with your body. And that is the only thought moment you give 100% to yourself, that is the compassion. And you feel the sympathetic joy. When and where are you here and now? You are fully contented. And that is the one you can verify under your very nose. And then when you keep on continue one thought moment, second, third, fourth, then you feel the equanimity. Any person who recognize or understand, verify within oneself metta, he is qualified to radiate metta to the other. So therefore, only the mindful moment, you become qualified yourself to radiate metta, and even with you are, whether you are radiating or not, you are emitting a good vibration. That's why people are attracted to him. No, no. So you, Bhante, you. So he looked better earlier. But the way he is acting and everything all the time. He emphasizing mindfulness, but he is talking highly about the metta, karuna, mudita. But the secret is, he is mindful. Whatever he is doing, no harm. First do no harm, and therefore he love himself. So invariably he is having a good vibration. And therefore I would say, we people are in a conscious army. Each moment you become mindful, you reduce the global warming. You reduce the pollution of the environment, because your mind is lack of pollution, reduce pollution. That's all I have to mention. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our deepest thanks to all the 3 speakers, Yuta Damo Bhikkhu, Venerable Dhammajiva, and Ajahn Brahm. Let's give them another round of applause, please. And before we invite you out for lunch, I'd like to just highlight that there are actually 2 books on meditation by Ajahn Brahm. One is Mindfulness and Beyond, and if you really want to disappear, there is a book called Act of Disappearing. Please be back here at 12:25 p.m. Lunch is available for you at the mezzanine area, and you can eat in the Telus room or the patio or in the area itself. Before you leave the hall, we would like to have the Bhikkhu Sangha's members to leave for their lunch first. So we'd like to invite all the Sangha members to rise. And I apologize for not introducing myself. I'm Angie Chu, and I'd love to meet all of you later on.